From Planned Parenthood to the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to Trump Care, we've got it covered right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know, I'm thinking of writing an article. I might write it tonight. I'm battling demons more than Democrats, or we're battling demons more than Democrats, by which I mean that our battle is ultimately spiritual and not primarily with a political party. I could have said the same about Republicans, but it doesn't rhyme as well as demons and Democrats. Some on the right would refer to the Democrats. Hey, the bottom line is our hope is ultimately not in Washington. This is Michael Brown. Welcome to The Line of Fire. Here's the number to call to get in the conversation today. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. I am not focusing on the interview I had yesterday with Dr. Michael Heiser about the Book of Enoch and the New Testament. But if you listen to it and you have a question and you want to call in a little later in the show, I might take some calls on that. But that's not my focus today. However, I do want to give you space. If you had a question, it was fresh in your mind from yesterday, the phone lines will be open, 866-34-TRUTH, but it'll be a little later in this hour before I'm able to get to those calls, if at all. Donald Trump repealing the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, replacing it with the Paul Ryan bill, others have called Trump Care, and the failure to get that through, Paul Ryan having to pull that before it was voted down in the House. And this means division within the Republican Party, not just opposition from the Democratic Party. I read an article, interesting article, that said, you know, Donald Trump is used to negotiating. And he fashions himself as a master negotiator, but he's used to negotiating with people who care about making a profit, who care about money. And that's different than negotiating with politicians who have other things in mind, who have other goals in mind, who have other values and priorities in mind. It becomes a different animal. And on the one hand, our founding fathers instituted things the way they did with the three branches of government, judicial, executive, and legislative. And they ordered things in such a way that there would be some type of gridlock, meaning that you could not just have a dictatorial leader. You could not just have a king saying, this is the way we do things. So the fact that things get stalled and there's pushback and, okay, that's part of the system. And obviously the final arbiter in all of it was never meant to be the Supreme Court. The way that's been set up and the way it's developed, I should say, is certainly contrary to the original vision. But the idea of having to deal with lifetime politicians, the idea of having to deal with people who may put political career before principle, I don't think that's something that the founding fathers countenanced or envisioned when they set up the system the way we have it. Now, by the way, I'm not saying that Donald Trump was on the right side of this issue or Paul Ryan was on the right side of this issue. From my take, which is a take of very, very little, well, no expertise. So just from an interested bystander, my take was that those who voted for Donald Trump were expecting a more comprehensive repeal and a more radical replacement than was being offered. So I was personally not disappointed that things got stalled along the way and that it brings some humiliation along the way. Perhaps this will drive Mr. Trump to his knees more. Perhaps he'll realize he needs a wisdom beyond himself, which, of course, his godly counselors have been telling him the whole way. But I'm not looking at this as the wholesale collapse of things. I'm just looking at it as typical Washington gridlock. The swamp is deeper than we realize. We come back. Are you ready to have your eyes opened? You don't want to miss this next segment.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
What is whiteness or blackness, or, you know, what does it mean to fall in between, or in what ways are we who we are? I'm not part of that owning, praising, living whiteness. Like, that's not me.
Rachel Dolezal is black. Is back in the news. Is black in the news. Yeah, a slight Freudian slip there. Here is a white woman, biologically white woman, born of white parents, who has identified as black and was actually a black civil rights leader before it came out that she wasn't actually black. And she said, hey, it's who I perceive myself to be. I am transracial. If you have transgender, why can't you have transracial? So Rachel Dolezal is on BBC. She's speaking with Emily Mattis about her new book, In Full Color. Let's listen to the interaction.
When you started ticking the box that said black eventually, did you feel uncomfortable? Did it feel like a lie?
No. I mean, it didn't feel like a lie, for sure. It felt like a true representation of who I am and what I stand for. Because in race, even though race is a social construct in America, there is a very clear color line. There's a very clear divide, and you have to take a side. Like, I stand on the black side of issues, philosophically, politically, socially, and for me to not check that box, I felt like would be some sort of a betrayal of not only who I am, but also the community I affiliate with.
The fact that this is even being discussed is another issue of the day in which we live, a day of social madness, a day in which perception becomes reality. I'm not mocking this woman. In fact, my heart goes out to this woman. Long term, even if she has a book and it sells well, I think ultimately she's hurt herself more than helped herself. But as she's speaking to Emily Mattis on BBC, she makes the statement that race is a social construct. Since when? We're told now that gender is a social construct, and it's really whatever you perceive yourself to be, how many multiple identities that might be, or how many identities in conflict with your biological sex. No, gender is a social construct. Now we're told race is a social construct, and I guess skin color, ethnicity, I guess these things are also social constructs. If you want to see where this leads, if you want to see why we have been raising our voice against this mentality that perception equals reality, keep listening. Here's more of the dialogue.
We don't have a choice in how we are born and who we are. And so to embrace and fully own who you really are, I think is something that we encourage from children's movies to are the most inspirational books, and whether fictional or accurate, I think that we tell everybody, be who you are, be proud of who you are. And this is truly who I am.
But do you think you had a choice? Did you have a choice to be black?
I was born as who I am, and that includes how I feel and also what I look like. And so I don't think that I have a choice in that.
Rachel, you are a white woman. That's not negotiable. It's not like you had a black father and a white mother, all right, and your complexion is in between. It's not like there was intermarriage over a period of time and your complexion is like 70% this and 30% this or your racial characteristics. No, you are a white woman. You are a Caucasian. Why not say, I am a Caucasian woman, I am a white woman who deeply identifies with the black community. I am a white woman that feels great solidarity with the black community. I am a white woman who is outraged over injustices in the black community. I want to stand with them. I am a white woman who feels like I'm black in my heart. Fine, you can say all that, but don't say you're black because you are not. This is not something up for negotiation. Look, I feel very young at heart. I just had a very heavy workout with my trainer this morning. I am 62 years old. It doesn't matter that I might feel like I'm 20 or 30 at heart. That is the reality. I might feel like I'm from Mars. I might feel like I'm from Pluto. It doesn't mean that I am. To the core of my being, I might feel like the wolf spirit, and I am actually a wolf at heart. I am a human being, a Caucasian male, 62 years old. That is reality. This whole idea that perception is reality. Now you're going to have a serious discussion about it on BBC. This is cultural madness. One more clip.
Gender is understood. We've progressed. We've evolved into understanding that gender is not binary. It's not even biological, you know. But what strikes me as so odd is that race isn't biological either. And actually, race has been to some extent less biological than gender, if you really think about history and our bodies. We are type A or type O or whatever blood. We don't, you know, there's no like white blood and black blood, and, you know, there's not like body parts that are, you know, certain, you know.
So you believe in a concept of transracial?
Well, I believe that the word transracial has become socially useful in describing racial fluidity and identity.
All right, so here, this is why we have raised our voices about other issues in terms of the war on gender and the war on reality. You know, she started to say they're not biological parts that identify gender. Hey, have you had an ultrasound? Ladies, have you had an ultrasound? And maybe you're 6 months in, and the nurse there says, it's a boy. You should say, no, that's just the packaging. We don't really know what's inside. We're going to have to wait. In fact, we're just going to have a gender-neutral name for our kid, Jerry, because Jerry could be male or Jerry could be female. So we'll have a gender-neutral name for our kid. And this way, as it grows up, then we'll know, however, it identify. That is not how the world works. I understand there are kids who are intersex and there's a biological chromosomal abnormality. I understand that. We deal with that like any other handicap or issue. Do our best to try to find that person, find real wholeness. And I understand there are people with deep emotional, psychological issues that feel deeply to the core of their being that their gender is contrary to the biological sex. We have compassion on them and want to help them, but we do not deny the realities that there are biological ways to identify who's male, who's female. There are chromosomal ways to identify who's male and female, and there are ways to identify who is black and who is white, even if you have some that are mixed and things like that. We can identify these things. It's not that mysterious. And by the way, when it comes to blood types, let's use that as an example. You're rushed into the hospital, all right? And they need your blood type because you need an immediate transfusion. Otherwise, you're going to die. And you say, well, I identify as this blood type. That's how I've always identified. And I understand that people with this blood type have certain characteristics, and that's me to a T. They don't care how you identify. They want to know what is the blood type. We are talking about realities. And the only positive here is the more this social madness gets exposed, the more people will say, sorry, but the emperor has no clothes. All right. What can you say to something like that other than God help Rachel Dolezal? And God help those who are buying into this. And yet we got transgender, and we've got transracial, and we've got trans species. I've written about all these things. You think I go home each day and think, let me dig through the news. Let me sift through the news. Let me find some obscure website somewhere that's talking about the latest example of this, and let me find something and write an article on it. No, it's when too many things come knocking at my door, when too many articles arrive in my inbox, when too many newscasts discuss these things. Hey, I believe was it this Friday night? There's going to be a major news network. Is it ABC is going to do a major special on gender identity and things like that? And I'm sure, I'm 99% sure it's going to go the typical prevailing way of the culture. This is going to be ABC, if I'm correct. We must simply say, hey, we're going to stand up for sanity. We're going to stand up for reality. We're going to stand up for that which is true. And we are not going to buy the lie that perception is reality. All right. Haven't said a word yet about Neil Gorsuch. I want to. We've got to talk about the latest with Planned Parenthood. A bunch of other things on my list to cover today. 866-348-7884. By the way, if you're a person of color listening, how do you feel when you hear this stuff? We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We have the people who do our paperwork for the field death certificates. They email us calling them baby. Baby this, baby right. that, uh-huh. baby so-and-so. And I'm like, that's creepy.
Former Planned Parenthood Medical Director Deshaun Taylor. Planned Parenthood, again, in the news, rightly so. This is Michael Brown, delighted to be with you, 866-34-TRUTH. Two things of interest and basically breaking within a day of each other. Yesterday, LifeSite News reports pro-life investigator charged with 15 felonies for exposing Planned Parenthood baby parts sales. Wow. State of California charged pro-life investigators David DeLaden and Sandra Merritt of the Center for Medical Progress with 15 crimes Tuesday. Remember they were charged in Texas and then those charges were thrown out. CMP's undercover videos show Planned Parenthood executives haggling over the prices of aborted baby parts. It spurred a congressional investigation and calls for the abortion company to be stripped of its federal tax dollars. DeLaden said in a statement to LifeSite News, quote, "These bogus charges from Planned Parenthood's political cronies are fake news. They tried the same collusion with corrupt officials in Houston, Texas, and both the charges and the DA were thrown out." Today, breaking news, that the new video released by the Center for Medical Progress shows Deshaun Taylor, a former medical director with Planned Parenthood, discussing late-term abortions and the possibility of delivering babies intact so their organs can be harvested. Let's listen to one more clip, clip number one. This is Deshaun Taylor speaking again.
Part of the issue is it's not a matter of how I feel about it coming out intact, but I got to worry about my staff and all people's feelings about it coming out looking like a baby.
Wow. How are people going to feel if the aborted baby comes out looking like a baby? And what about a death certificate for baby this or baby that? Isn't it saying it is really a baby? So, I mean, this is horrific stuff. And what does the state of California do instead of talking about the evils of abortion? No. State of California is going to go after the Center for Medical Progress. So you're guilty of felonies for getting this information. Deshaun Taylor formerly held an academic position at the University of Southern California while doing abortions at Planned Parenthood Los Angeles. She also worked as the medical director of Planned Parenthood Arizona and currently runs her own abortion facility in Arizona, Desert Star Family Planning. Taylor hedges around the issue of what to do if a baby is born alive after an abortion. Quote, well, the thing is, I mean, the key is you need to pay attention to who is in the room, right? What? You need? Can we hear that again? Well, the thing is, I mean, the key is you need to pay attention to who's in the room, right? If the baby is born alive, surely if you're going to kill the baby, You got to see who's in the room. And if it's people sympathetic to it, presumably that's what she's saying, there's no problem. Otherwise, you got a problem. Taylor gives this answer after CMP journalist posing as a fetal tissue buyer asked if there's, quote, any standard procedure for verifying signs of life. Arizona law requires any baby born alive at any age after an attempted abortion to be taken to a hospital, a fact Taylor admits to being very familiar with. Taylor's admission that, quote, who's in the room matters more than actually determining if the baby is alive is even more horrifying because she commits abortions on viable babies who could survive outside the womb if they had been delivered in a hospital at the same age. Taylor explains, quote, I go up to 24 weeks. Most of the patients that come to me are elective. Oh, gosh. I mean, how brutal, how horrific, how this destroys this mindset that, oh, well, it's only these emergency life and death cases and, you know, and incest and rape and that's why we're doing it and we're going to die otherwise. And she says, no, most are elective, just choosing to do it. And she goes up to 24 weeks. So if you heard my interview last night with one of the authors of the Kermit Gosnell book and the House of Horrors of Kermit Gosnell, that stuff is not unique. Other things like this have happened in other abortion clinics and just been covered over. How many years was he doing what he did? So Kristen Burton Brown, I believe on LifeSite News, reporting on this, she said, this flies in the face of the common narrative that most late-term abortions are done for medical reasons, an argument that is debunked both here and different links by current and former abortionists. For those who think late-term abortion is decreasing, Taylor would seem to disagree. She tells the Center for Medical Progress, I feel pretty good. I mean, my market share of the abortion service is just, it continues to increase. She has a lengthy discussion with CMP journalists. We played a clip from it about how to best preserve the aborted or possibly born alive baby for harvesting purposes. She explains, it's not a matter of how I feel about it coming out intact, but I've got to worry about my staff and, you know, people's feelings about it coming out looking like a baby. Comes out looking like a baby. I mean, it could upset someone on the staff to make them realize what they're actually dealing with. That's why she typically does DNE abortions, which rip the child apart limb by limb. Oh, this is the more compassionate thing to do, lest the baby comes out looking like a baby. This way it's just baby parts. How horrific. She said, I just don't even want to send a full fetus for cremation or any of that. She says, we have the people who do our paperwork for the fetal death certificates. They email us calling them babies, baby this, baby that, baby so-and-so. And I'm like, that's creepy. No, 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 no. Miss Taylor, what you do is creepy. No, it's horrific. No, it is killing babies in the womb. No, it is terminating the life of babies that could potentially survive outside of the womb. In modern medical practice, this article continues, the survival rate of babies born at 24 weeks is 65%, and 97% of babies this age born in the hospital receive active treatment to save their lives. We come back. I want to continue talking about transracial perception as reality, especially if you're a person of color. Give me a call. Tell me how you feel about that. Or if you're a woman, how do you feel about a man identifying as a woman and getting to play on women's sports teams? Just the kinds of things that we're dealing with today. 866-348-7884. Have you ordered yet your copy of Dr. Michael Heiser's book and our exclusive interview, Book of Enoch, Forgotten Mission of Jesus? Check it out. Fascinating interview. You get the book and the CD. Go to the website, thelineoffire.org.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Save the nation. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on the line of fire. Hey, you know, one thing, just getting back to politics, the Washington swamp is a lot deeper than people might realize. And draining it is going to be a lot more challenging than a lot of people realize. And if Donald Trump can't drain it, yeah, he's got his faults and his failings and his shortcomings. I understand that. But if Donald Trump can't drain it, I wonder who is going to be able to drain it. Just thinking out loud, honestly. 866-348-7884 is the number to call. We'll start in Fairfax, Virginia. Sharon, welcome to the line of fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown.
Hello.
How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're speaking right into your phone. I'm not on speaker, right?
Okay. Well, yes, yeah, you are, but I'm
It's hard to hear you. It's hard to hear you on speaker. So tell you what, Sharon, this is for our listeners, all right? Very hard to hear you when you're on speaker. So we'll give you a second to just pick up the phone and be on the regular phone. If you can do that, great. Otherwise, we can't hear you. So let's try that again. Here we go.
Can you hear me?
Perfectly now.
Is that better?
Much
better. Okay, great. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Wonderful. The young lady that has white skin and she claims to be, you know, the a black woman.
Yep.
You know, the thing is, with me, I'm a fair-skinned African-American woman. I have white skin relatives in my family. And, you know, I mean, both of their parents are African-Americans. So, you know, one thing, you know, the stigmatism that we have here in this country is, you know, always asking, are you black? Are you white? You know, you have to choose one or the other. But, you know, I kind of agree with the young lady, you know, I mean, she's, if she has, you know, white skin, she... How do you feel black? How do you feel white? I mean, you know, it's really...
But does it matter how you feel? In other words, let's say there's an affirmative action program for black Americans because of certain problems or injustices or issues like that. What if someone else, Caucasian, raised in the suburbs and, you know, a lot of money in the family, but just feels black and wants to take advantage of that affirmative action? Is that what it's there for? Is it fair?
You say it's not fair that they take advantage of, they have the money. That's why, you know, that's what I was going to go to say is, you know, it's a lot of stigmatism in this country with black and white. So, you know, I mean, you know, and you fill out an application. That's one question. I never answer that question is, you know, what is your race? I always, you know, put a little box and says human race. You know, I write human in there.
Right.
And that's what, you know, people are people. You know, people are people. I mean, in this country, you know, it's really funny when I travel abroad. I see white Americans and, you know, we just, you know, small talk and, oh, where are you from? And, you know, there's a bond. But
right.
When you come back to this country, then, you know, it's business as usual. And I believe it really needs to stop. You know, the young lady, I have much respect for Rachel, for, you know.
Yeah, but look, I understand your perspective, you know, as a fair-skinned black American. And I think you're onto something when you talk about the divisions in our country. But denying the reality that there is such a thing as race, that's the issue. When you become a civil rights leader as a black person, you're actually Caucasian, and you try to make yourself look black. That's deception.
Give us strength to always do what's right. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for being part of the dialogue and discussion today on The Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown, your voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity in the midst of a society and chaos in a church all too often in compromise. 866-348-7884. Just back to our previous caller. I absolutely agree that we make too much of an issue of race in America. And I believe that is largely a result of our identity politics and constantly raising these issues. Now, where there are issues to raise, where there is injustice against a certain portion of the population, where there is mistreatment, where there is systemic racism, when any of these things exist, yes, by all means, we need to address them. But our emphasis should be that we're one people, that we are a racial melting pot and we are one nation. And yes, the race to which we all belong is the human race. And then we find great diversity in the different cultures and backgrounds and ethnicities and things like that. As I was preaching Sunday morning in Atlanta, in pretty much an all-black church and maybe 30% of the congregation being from Africa itself, including the pastor. And I just said, I love preaching in black churches in America. There's a certain vitality and, you know, the folks talk back to you during the message, and I really enjoy the environment. Now, Friday night, Saturday morning, I spoke in a wonderful Messianic Jewish congregation, also right near Atlanta, Roswell. And love the atmosphere there and love their worship and their hunger for the word. And that was another expression. There was diversity there. So I can appreciate the diversity. And just like if you want Italian food and someone else wants Chinese food, maybe you go to a food court in the mall and this one gets Italian, this one gets Chinese. You don't mix it all together in a blender so that it just becomes some slop. You enjoy the different tastes and all that. So no one's trying to say everybody has to be the same. No, let us have our different cultural expressions, our different racial expressions, our different ethnic expressions as part of one country, as fellow Americans, as part of the human race. But when it comes to identifying and saying, I am black, when you're actually white, let's say you are from Mexico and you've been here 10 years and you're a citizen legally, but you don't like this idea of being an Hispanic American right now because you think you're being looked at negatively and people think you're one of these undocumented undocumented people that are here in the country and that you're just going to be associated with some bad guy that should be in prison or whatever. So now you're going to identify as something else. You can't do that. You can't change ethnicity or race. And when you can change gender, 866-348-7884. We go to Tony in Oxon Hill, Maryland. Welcome to The Line of Fire.
Hey, Michael Brown. I appreciate you allowing me to express my perspective.
Please.
Basically, it was just about the young lady who was identifying with the black culture. I don't know a lot of it, but just in general.
And actually saying she's black. I mean, she yeah. for years said she was black,
right.
And she was a leader in the NAACP before
right.
it was found out she wasn't black.
Okay. Well, I mean, there's two sides to that situation that I have an opinion on. One, I do agree with you with regards to if you're going to get detailed as far as filling out applications, forms, blood types, things of that nature, I do feel that you should be true and honest with who you really are in your culture and your upbringing, your heritage, should I say. But as far as a culture and as far as identifying with a particular group and that particular food, that particular way of life, those particular way of living in general, I don't feel anything wrong with that at all. I feel that people have a choice to be a part of who they want to be a part of.
Right.
That's the whole beauty of love and coming together. I think that's in general what the base of what God wants us to do anyway, is to share our cultures, to share an understanding of who we are and where we came from, so that we can break those barriers. In that essence, I do agree with her, and I'm on her side. But on the other side, I agree with you, where basically when she becomes technical with regards to policies and procedures and all those types of identifications and the legal scenarios that cause her to have to identify, then that's where I disagree.
It's what I'm saying. Why can't you say I'm a white person that deeply identifies with black culture? And I feel like I'm black at heart. Look, it would just be like if you said I'm Jewish because you want to stand with Israel and with, you know, and when you're not, you know, presumably that you're not, you could say, hey, look, I'm a Jew at heart. I'm an Israeli at heart. Yeah, I'm a black American, so, you know, but I'm a Jew at heart, and I stand with the Jews, and I relate to the Jewish, I relate to the cause. I feel like we're one. Mm-hmm. Say all the amen to all of it
without crossing that line. What if you were born, right? You were born from day one in that culture. And just like many of that culture, any culture, actually, that's all you see. Say, for example, no disrespect to the Asian culture, but just to say you were born in China, and that's all you saw.
Yeah.
Right. And so as you grew up, that's all you knew. You knew the language, you knew the intonation and know how to verbalize the language when you speak it, articulate it very well. And that's what you identify with. You know, where do you go with that?
Yeah,
you know
absolutely.
What I mean? You have to identify with something. And then you start to realize, wait a minute, I don't look like them. Oh, my gosh. And then it becomes a shock, a culture shock.
Right. Now, look, I know people that grew up in other cultures. I read an extraordinary book, Child of the Jungle, by a woman. When she was a little girl, she and her family moved to work with tribal people, the Fayu people, in Indonesia or New Guinea. And these were primitive people, you know, naked when they got their bones in their nose, they're warring with each other. And she lived there for years of her life. And then when she had to move to Europe, it was totally disorienting for her. And you know, she's just talking about being on a subway or being on a train and going from one place to another. And she didn't know who was going to attack her. And she thought, I don't even have my spear, you know, and she could not figure out. She was a child of two different worlds. And so no one's denying any of that. I mean, Rachel Dolezal was actually raised by white parents, but no one's denying those things. It would simply be, you know, if you know, you could say, look, I'm Chinese to the core, but everybody understands. Okay. You're a Caucasian, or you're a Hispanic, or you're black, and you're not ethnically Chinese. But yeah, people would know it. They'd know you understand the culture. They know by the language that you speak, you'd be welcome. But nobody would be tricked into thinking that you're ethnically Chinese. So Tony, amen to the identification and to the cultural connections and to the interaction. And, you know, look, there's the joke about some people are Oreos. They're black on the outside and white on the inside. And then, you know, we had a friend that used to lead worship leader, and we said he was the blackest white man we knew because the way he led and sang and felt, it was very black, and it had a certain soul to it. So amen to all of that. Nobody's ever argued with that. It's just when you present yourself as contrary to what you are. I'm going to be the new leader of Hispanic Americans, and I'm Hispanic. Well, I'm not Hispanic. Doesn't matter what side of the bed I wake up or where I grew up. Hey, thank you, Tony. I appreciate it. 866-348-7884. Let's go to Laquisha in Errico, Virginia. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, thank you for having me on the Line of Fire. Thank you.
You're welcome.
just a comment on what we're talking about, the discussion of today is very interesting. My first thing is, and I am a quote-unquote a black person, but the question needs to be answered, what makes you black? Black is actually not a race. It is actually considered a color. So what makes the person who is black, black? What classifies us as being black? And what classifies those who are non-black as white? And why is not the Asian classified as yellow or the Native American as red? Why is it that the black only is the only one who is classified as black? But
well, and white. Whites are classified as white.
But they're also classified as Caucasian.
Yeah, but normally we just say blacks and whites in America. You know what I'm saying?
White, you said it's Caucasian. What other designation do you have for a black person?
Well, Negroid, which sounds demeaning, but it's not. It's just an anthropological term. So you'd have Caucasian, you'd have Negroid, and that's where Negro came from originally. But I thought some, correct me if I'm wrong, please. I thought some of these designations came from the Black American community, whether it identified as Negro, then said we want to identify as Black, or now as African American. Am I wrong in that, in terms of where this came from?
Yeah, because they told us. See, we received all these classifications from other people.
Okay.
They brought it to us and told us that this was a generally accepted classification for us, and we bought into it because we had no identity. One thing about us as a people.
All right, tell you what, stay right there. It's back to you on the other side of the break. All right, as soon as we come back, I want to hear what you have to say. By the way, I remember a very powerful rant from Muhammad Ali where he talked about, you know, angel food, you know, that's white, and black is, you know, all dark, devil, demonic, negative.
God of light, hear our cry, send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
So what does it mean to be black or white? Where did these designations come from? Back to LaQuisha in Virginia. Go ahead, please.
Hi. LaQuisha.
LaQuisha, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, and I was stating to the young man's comment that was before you, he gave an excellent question about if I grew up in Asia and I have the culture and I have the language, you know, but then I move somewhere else. Am I not Asian? It came to my mind, the scripture came to my mind, was that who told you you were naked? Who told you if you are brought up in a certain way and you have the heart and you have the mind and you have the way of life of a certain group of people, who has the right to tell you that you are not of that people? Who tricked us into believing that we are just black people? When black had a totally different designation when the word black came out. Because remember, the origin of black meant fair, it meant pure, it meant with blemished, it meant without color. So how can something without color become a person of color? How can it switch up like that on us?
So how would you say that we address the identification issue? I'm not into identity politics. I'm not into dividing over these things. Of course, we see this one's male, this one's female, this one's tall, this one's short, this one's dark skin, this one's light skin. But to me, they're just fellow human beings in different shapes, sizes, and forms. What would, in your view, be the best way that we approach these things?
By scripture. How did scripture define the people?
All right, and that would then have nothing to do with skin color. That would have to do with, of course, spiritual relationship with God, those who are children of God, those who aren't. And then we would be identified ethnically. That's why Jesse Lee Peterson, a black leader on my show, who very controversial in his comments, said racism doesn't exist. Racism is just an excuse to attack and hurt people, etc. In other words, there's no such thing as dividing over race. It's that you have from this ethnicity or that ethnicity, so this one's American, this one's Mexican, this one's Canadian, etc.
Yeah.
And but you know, that would be an argument in that regard. But I appreciate you raising these more fundamental issues. We need to put them on the table for discussion.
Thank you. You have a blessed day.
Yeah, you too. God bless you. Thank you. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Herb in Manassas, Virginia. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes, Brother Brown, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity. I think you're doing a great job.
Well, thank you, sir.
I have to say that I agree with you that as far as the various categories identifying blacks, that has gone through some redos starting in the 60s or so. I think back then we were referred to as African-Americans, and some of the leadership of the black community would change that to blacks. That's one thought I have for you. And the other thought is that as far as people feeling certain ways and living life on their emotions, then we lose a sense of the real truth of things. And truth is a very objective attribute. And so it is defined within some very limited boundaries. Also, we being identified as blacks or whites or Asians, I think originally those designations were basically used to identify not so much the person, but the origin of the person. Do you follow me?
Yeah, and what Lakeisha pointed out would be, okay, why do you say Asian? Why do you say Hispanic, but then black? In other words, then you could say African or something else.
African-American.
Right, right, right. So hence African-American, Hispanic-American, Asian-American, you'd all be identified by a sub-ethnic category as opposed to by skin color. So that's a fair point. Why do we make the big different divisions by skin color? And why do we say we got blacks, you've got whites, but we don't say you have yellows or reds, right? So there are inconsistencies there. And I think with everything, let's step back. Let's step back and say, how should we obviously identify as all fellow members of the human race and fellow Americans? But what's the best way to work these things out? And yet, Herb, you're absolutely right. We don't want to play with truth. Because once you play with truth and reality, we're sunk. Hey, thank you for weighing in, sir. I appreciate it. All right, let's grab one more call. Craig in Richmond. We're a little short on time, so please weigh right in.
Yes, sir. How are you doing, Dr. Brown?
I'm doing great. Thank you, sir.
Great, great. You know, the question is, you know, a lot of times we talk about identifying as black, identifying as white, and it's not how we identify each other. The issue really comes down to how we love or don't love each other. And if race has to be a reason to determine whether we love or don't love, then the problem is not so much who you don't love. The problem is in your own heart.
Yep.
I got no problem with Rachel Dolezal, none whatsoever. I know what she did was shady and all of that, but here's the issue. If she will stand beside me in the fight that I'm in and take a brick like I take a brick, I can't be mad at her. I can't. Okay, the bottom line is that, you know, until we get to the point, and we've been talking about it for years and years and years, Dr. Brown, I think you know that, and I know that, that this country is, we call it a melting pot, but maybe it hasn't melted so much because there's still division. Maybe it hasn't blended so much because there's still too much division. And until it gets right in the heart, it'll never change. Identity will never matter if you love. Because you just be another person that you love, that you will embrace as a human being. You'll appreciate the diversity that person brings because of their upbringing, their background, their origins. And when all of that becomes a non-issue but something to appreciate, like the colors of a rainbow, then that'd be great. And I'm not talking about the gay rainbow, so I hope nobody gets
wrong. Yeah. No, we're clear.
But if we just kind of get to the point where we just stop looking at it that way. I mean, I am a black man and I love being a black man. You're a Jewish person. I'm sure you love being a Jewish person. And I appreciate the fact that you celebrate your heritage like I celebrate mine. I don't see a problem with that. I don't. I actually don't. I just wish we get to the point where we just learn that the issue is not a color, culture, or any issue. It's a love issue.
Yeah, Craig, if we could hear that message a whole lot more, we could take some strides forward. And our unity is found in our diversity, just like the beauty of a symphony orchestra is the many different instruments that are all different and all sounding their different notes in a beautiful harmony. So it does come back. It comes down to loving other people as people and loving as God loved and respecting and honoring different heritages and different. You know, it's like you may like a certain style of music. I don't. Doesn't mean it's bad music. I might like a certain kind of food. You don't. Doesn't mean it's good food or bad. We just celebrate differences. I mean, those are the most superficial. But, hey, I'm out of time, but I'm so glad you got to weigh in and to leave us on that note, which is a gospel note. And as Lakeisha said, let's go back to Scripture. Hey, thank you for weighing in. Remember, friends, our exclusive interview with Dr. Michael Heiser in his new book, Reversing Hermon, only at thelineoffire.org. Order today. My bottom line, let us love as Jesus loved. We'd rock the world. What does it mean to be a spiritual prepper? What about coming doomsday? Should we think about it?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Is doomsday coming? Are we about to go into a period of all-out chaos on the earth? How then should we live? Okay, weighty questions. We're going to talk about it today on The Line of Fire, but in a positive, practical way. We're going to be joined in a moment by Jake McCandless. He has a book just about ready to come out called Spiritual Prepper. So we'll be talking with Jake in a moment. To join me today on the air, 866-348-7884. I mentioned in the first hour that I am willing to take some calls. If you listened to my interview with Dr. Michael Heiser yesterday about the Book of Enoch and background to the New Testament, if you listened to this and you had questions, I'm open to take some calls on the subject, but that's not what I'm going to focus on immediately. 866-348-7884, though, is the number to call. Before I get to my guest, let me make a few comments about Justice Neil Gorsuch. On the one hand, his philosophy seems to be strongly in harmony with that of Justice Antonin Scalia. He seems to be an originalist, meaning that the original intended meaning of the Constitution is what we need to seek after and make application accordingly. And from certain things he has written, it seems that he would stand in the right place regarding abortion. And as far as his stances on religious liberties, there are a couple of rulings that point that he'd be in the right direction there. At the same time, he attends a liberal church and has spoken favorably about someone that he knew, a friend, being involved in a same-sex marriage, and his church embraces that viewpoint. And some of the answers that he gave during the hearings about abortion could make you wonder, well, where does he actually stand on it? Does he say Roe v. Wade is established and shouldn't be challenged? I personally took those answers in a way he was simply answering them legally. It is a precedent, and it's been affirmed a number of times, which means it carries weight. It doesn't mean it can't be overturned, can't be overthrown. He never said it can't be or it shouldn't be or it wouldn't be. As for where he would stand on issues having to do with revisiting the redefinition of marriage, which is something I hope the Supreme Court does take up, hard to say where he would stand. So here's where I'm at. I believe that President Trump has done exactly what he promised. He had a list of justices vetted by Planned Parenthood. I have colleagues on the front lines of this battle who feel very good about Justice Gorsuch. The degree of opposition from the Democrats tells you that he would be a candidate that would be a good candidate for the Supreme Court and hopefully someone that could rule rightly in the decades ahead. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you never know ultimately what someone will do once elected. No, Scalia didn't really surprise us, and Alito hasn't surprised us, and Thomas hasn't surprised us, and Roberts, when it came to Obamacare, he surprised us. Other ways he hasn't, Justice Kennedy has swung left more and more over the years. So that's not a surprise now, but it might have been a surprise back in the beginning when he was first appointed under Republican president. So all that to say, I'd like to see Gorsuch confirmed. I believe he'd do a good job, but I really don't know. I don't know with a deeper conviction where he would rule on certain key issues. So I still don't put my trust in him or the Supreme Court. We'll be right back with Jake McCandless.
Flame, send the It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm looking at a brand new book just about to be hot off the press, Spiritual Prepper. The subtitle, Tapping into Overlooked Prophecies to Prepare for Doomsday. It's written by Jake McCandless. He's founder, executive director, and speaker for Prophecy Simplified, a former pastor. He holds a BA in Bible from Central Baptist College in Conway, Arkansas, and an MDiv, Master of Divinity, from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. Jake, great to have you on the Line of Fire today.
Well, great. Michael, thanks for having me, and thank you for this opportunity.
Sure thing. All right. Spiritual Prepper. Coming Doomsday. What's this all about?
Well, the title and the subtitle, they're probably a little bit of a play on words, but the heart behind the book is that there are some prophecies that when you think prophecies, you think the Antichrist, Mark of the Beast, the geopolitical scene there at the end, but there's some prophecies that are just missed that talk about the humanity and especially Christians at the end of the age in terms of their spirituality and their morality. And one such passage is Matthew 24:10. It says that many will turn away. And I, as a pastor, I began to get captured by that passage, and I stand before my congregation and ask that question. Are they prepared for what is coming in terms of just difficulty? Are the challenges right now in their lives, are they prepared to remain faithful? And so really became this passion on my heart that we wouldn't just be physically prepared for what may come, we would be spiritually prepared as well.
All right, let's just say we went back to the 60s, and it was the time of the counterculture revolution in late 60s, Hal Lindsey's book, Late Great Planet Earth, came out, and 67, Jerusalem comes back in Jewish hands, and the Six-Day War. I became a heavy drug user late 60s, early 70s, playing drums in a rock band, then got radically saved in 1971, but we had the mentality Jesus is coming in any minute, we're going to be out of here any second, and just kind of live accordingly. So on the one hand, the date setting was wrong, but culture has changed quite dramatically since then, and the church was certainly not ready for it. So regardless of setting dates and end time schemes, we can really ask, is the church ready for the culture in which it finds itself today and the culture that seems to be coming around the corner? So this is a practical question regardless of where we stand in terms of prophecy and the end of the age, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Throughout the book, I really walk through Matthew 24, which we know as Jesus saying, these are the signs of my return. These are the birth pains or the beginning contractions of that end. And they definitely talk about a specific event, but they were happening right then as he was saying them. They happened right there to those first disciples, and every generation of Christian has had to face those same challenges, and we're facing them right now, regardless of where the end is. We're facing them, and what is staggering to me is I ran across a statistic coming from David Sanford, an author out of Portland. He had written in his book, If God Disappears, that at this time, right now, there are 42 million Christians who have professed and practiced their faith within the church who no longer attend or practice in any way. And that is staggering when I heard those, and then I was seeing it on a practical level as a pastor.
All right, so let's start to talk this through. And friends, let me just remind you, regardless of your eschatology, regardless of how you see the end of the age, regardless if you read Matthew as it appears Jake does and I do, Matthew 24 as events that were current in Jesus' day and right before the destruction of the Second Temple, and events that will be especially current at the end of the age before Jesus physically returns, whether you read it like that or in a different way, the principles here remain the same, because in point of fact, there is intense persecution for believers around the world. In point of fact, there's an attack on our religious liberties today that didn't exist a generation ago. So we must wake up, and when we see so many casualties, when we see so many people falling by the wayside, we have to say, okay, something's wrong, something needs to change. That's what the book Spiritual Prepper is about. It is a practical response to scriptural warnings and the day in which we find ourselves. So let's highlight some of the chapters here, Jake, some of the themes. And again, get the book Spiritual Prepper to get all the meat of it. But let's start with chapter 2, Prepping to be Faithful. Doesn't that just come automatically? I mean, aren't we just faithful automatically as followers of Jesus? What do we have to prep for?
Well, I don't know if remaining faithful is really in the American evangelical language today.
Uh-huh.
You know, where from pastoring and being around churches, I'm in and out of churches multiple times a week with my ministry, and you know, the focus is on your destination, on that salvation, but there's not a lot of talk about, especially in America, that you're going to face challenges, and you need to remain faithful through those. And so I really think that's something missing in our language that maybe has been understood in the past, that perseverance, that steadfastness. And so, no, I think that's something that needs to be discussed, that just we need to be discussing, hey, we need to be faithful, and where I really see this playing out is, you know, I think we know that we only make it to heaven by grace and through faith. But I know when we see the Lord, we're going to want to hear those words, well done, and good, my good and faithful servant. And so, you know, our faithfulness, if it doesn't matter to us now, it's surely going to matter when we see the Lord and we step into eternity. So I think we need to be living for that now.
All right. So let's talk about this then. How do I prepare to be faithful? What, you're a pastor, what are you telling your congregation?
Well, throughout the book, I walk through a checklist of 25, which is a long list, but they're practical things that we need to do. But I really, two levels, I think. In, number one, the ultimate preparation is, you know, when the Lord gave his invitation to those first disciples, it was, come follow me. And they then drastically changed their life and walked with him. And we've got a brand of Christianity in America that really says, you know, come get the benefits, but you don't have to do anything. You don't have to follow, in a sense.
Right.
And so I believe that sense of walking with him and walking in the Spirit is, number one, the ultimate preparation. It's just that daily walk. But I think, just on a maybe practical level, is realizing that there are challenges to your faith and realizing that you very well could be, and I could be, one of those who turn away. And the phrase turn away there in Matthew 24 is the same used of in Matthew 26 as Jesus warns the disciples, especially Peter, about what they're going to do that night he's arrested. And it just really means to be caused to stumble. And so it doesn't have to mean that you just abandon the faith, you become an atheist, you give up believing. It's just that you stop, you have a lapse in your faithful walk.
All right, what about preparing for persecution? You've actually got chapters preparing for persecution, prepping for persecution, prepping for more persecution, prepping for fiery darts, prepping in a weakened church, prepping for difficult trials, prepping for temptation, prepping for false teaching, prepping against shiny things, prepping for hurt feelings, prepping to overcome. So, friends, you're talking about a practical book. Jake, in communist China, I have read and heard, and Corrie ten Boom shared this, that the people were told, the Christians were told, that they would be raptured out before tribulation hit. And then, for all practical purposes, tribulation hit with the horrific persecution they endured. And they said they weren't prepared for it. By God's grace, they made it and survived. But they said, we weren't prepared. We were told that before things got really bad, we'd be out of here. And there's that plays in with the American mentality that we can have a suffering-free faith. But regardless of pre-trib rapture or not, this is not true for the church through history and the church around the world. Why should we assume that we will go without persecution here in America?
Cool. That's a powerful statement you made there. And we're, what we have in America and this point in history in America, we're an anomaly. I mean, our brothers and sisters in Christ, previously and in all generations and right now across the world, face serious tribulation and persecution and martyrdom. And for us to not even really have that, and one of the things I list in that checklist is to just make the study of martyrdom part of our Christian education.
Yes, yes.
We come to the Lord with this idea that everything's just going to be a bed of roses, and especially in America, our prevailing end-time idea is man, we're going to be blessed. We're going to make America great. It's going to be wonderful. And then the Lord's going to show up and pull us out, and then tribulation will come. But you ask our brothers and sisters in Iraq and Syria right now about tribulation in the future, there's not even a worry of that because they're facing so much now.
Exactly.
And,
is beheading
not guaranteed it. It's just part of the walk.
Yeah, yeah. And here, a theoretical question. Is beheading under the Antichrist any more severe than beheading now? Is being tortured to death under the Antichrist any more severe than being tortured to death now? I think you get my drift. Hey, friends, this is a practical book, Spiritual Prepper. We'll be right back.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on the broadcast today. This is Michael Brown. I'm speaking with Jake McCandless. He is the author of Spiritual Prepper. It is a guide to families and churches who need encouragement in the face of loved ones who've turned away from God and their faith. As the fallen world races towards the day of judgment, the time to be prepared spiritually is now. And whether Jesus comes in 1 year or in 100 years, we're living in urgent times. Many are falling away. Many are being deceived. Many are not ready for persecution and opposition. I wonder, in how many of our churches around America, if there were hard times, tough times, if there was a price to pay for being a follower of Jesus, how many would follow? I've been to India now 24 straight years. And when we baptize people every year in India, the Indian brother I work with asks them if they're willing to follow Jesus to their last breath, to their last drop of blood. This is at water baptism. This is the norm. Jake, in your book, Spiritual Prepper, you deal with very, very practical subjects. And I read through the table of contents. Some deal with prepping in a weakened church, prepping for temptation, prepping for false teaching. Pull out any one or two chapters that you like and give me some of the ways that we can spiritually prepare so that we will be those who stand strong.
Yeah, we were talking before the break about persecution, and I deal with that quite a bit. The book begins with this, really what was going on in Iraq and Syria right now as you had ISIS marching in, and they were coming into the homes, and those who were Christians, they were marked, their homes were marked, and some were, you know, faced the ultimate sacrifice and questioned if they believed or not. And there were fathers and mothers who had to make decisions to say yes or no, if they would hold on to their faith and remain faithful and not deny the Lord, yes, at the loss of their life. But what really got me, as I have two young girls, is their daughters being sold into sexual slavery because of them remaining faithful. And so with that thought, and some of just the beginning of that, and me and my wife just sitting down at the table talking about, okay, what's our faith threshold? What is, and it comes down to our daughters. That's the, you know, that's the thing that,
right.
If a gun's put to my head, I'm not worried about my life, but I'm worried about them. And so I think it really helps having that conversation. The book contrast there at the end, the next to last chapter, is preparing for hurt feelings. And it's really just kind of meant to be a contrast that you have folks who are dying for the faith, but then here in America, in the grassroots of our churches, and, you know, as a pastor, one of the number one things I saw as I would visit with individuals in our community and those within our church, I'd hear things like, you know, Pastor, I was very faithful. I made a profession of faith as a child, was in the church, and then this event happened in my life, or so-and-so hurt my feelings, or Pastor, you hurt my feelings. So no longer attend. And so you have people, in a sense, walking away from practice of their faith based on hurt feelings. And when you contrast that to some losing their faith or imprisonment, you know, that should really wake us up to where we are at in America.
Yeah, absolutely so, Jake. And when I've preached over the years about serving God by life or by death, one of our grads from our ministry school, went with his family into very difficult territory in a Muslim country and was assassinated by Al-Qaeda terrorists. And there at the funeral, we talked about the price of following Jesus. A school slogan of ours was "By life or by death." And I remember preaching this message once, and a mother came up to me. And she said, "I've got 7 kids." She said, "I just kissed each of them, and I just said, you belong to the Lord." It's a mindset. We may never face the things that believers in Syria or Iraq have faced, but it's that mindset. We're here on a mission, not a vacation. This world, yeah, as A.W. Tozer said, it's a battleground, not a playground. And we must have that mentality. All right, briefly, again, friends, you'll have to get the book Spiritual Prepper to get all of the practical teaching guidelines, prophetic application. But how can you prepare for false teaching? Because false teaching doesn't come along and say, this is false, this is deceptive. How do you prepare for it?
Well, I think with all of it, I joke, I grew up in the 80s with G.I. Joe and Transformers, and they'd always end their show with a, you know, public service announcement, and they would end that with, now that you know, that's half the battle. And I think that's so true, is if we've got to realize these things are occurring. Right now, you can turn on the TV and find every 30 minutes or an hour, 5 or 6 different messages being preached. You find a different church on every corner. You find a different podcast or radio show to your choosing. Not everybody's going to be right, and not everybody's right. And we've got to realize what I believe is the number one warning in the New Testament is false teaching. I think you find it in maybe all but one book in the New Testament that false teachers will come. And so it's really, you know, it's knowing the truth. It's being able to be in the Word yourself. I think, you know, if you take over time, someone who comes to the Lord and they go through a Bible study, they go through a class at their church, they go just worship services and hear preaching, but they miss a concentrated training. And almost in every job, you're going to go through some type of training before you start that job.
Yep.
But in our Christian walk, we just, you know, just kind of think, well, we'll just meander through this and see what happens. And we really need to just dive into the Word, a concentrated effort to learn.
Yeah, and the fact that we have so many warnings in Scripture, and let no one deceive you with empty words, and be not deceived, and Paul talking about how he lived with discipline, so after he preached to others, he himself shouldn't be a castaway. We need that wake-up call, but we need it with something practical. People say to me, okay, great, you woke us up, now what? So your whole book is, okay, let's wake up, and this is what? This is how you live it out.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Yeah, and that false teaching, I really encourage, if someone has not had the chance to, you know, you need a formal degree, but I think you need to walk away and say, hey, I took this concentrated time, you know, enroll in a class, find a concentrated study up there, get somebody that is going to disciple you. I mean, we all need that accountability.
Yeah, and the thing that I appreciate, Jake, is that when the Bible tells us things about the future, it never tells us to give us abstract information. It tells us so that we'll recognize God as God and that we'll be prepared for what's coming. And certainly God has given us enough warnings and enough practical guidelines. Again, the book Spiritual Prepper, it is by Jake McCandless. There's some great endorsements for the book as well. And when is it coming out officially?
April 4th, so next week, available on WMD Superstore, Barnes & Noble. Right now, though, you can catch it. It's released already on Amazon. So if somebody wants a copy, go to Amazon.com, Spiritual Prepper, and you can find it.
Yeah, and in fact, when you order in advance on Amazon, they give you a price guarantee. So when it comes out, if it's any less, you get that difference. Awesome. Hey, may the Lord use this to get the people of God prepared. I appreciate it, Jake.
Great. Thanks for the opportunity, and thank you for your work.
You're very welcome. All right, friends, 866-348-7884. I'm going to be weighing in on a number of subjects, but everybody listening to me in North Carolina and Texas in particular, may I have your best year. Again, if you're listening to me in North Carolina or Texas, may I have your best year. We've got a lot to talk about.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown.
your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, I want everyone in particular listening in North Carolina and Texas to give me your best ear, all right? And everybody listening around the country, around the world, listen in, because this will be relevant for everyone. But in particular, if you live in North Carolina or if you live in Texas, this is Michael Brown. You're listening to The Line of Fire, your voice, moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Well, North Carolina, a couple years back, passed HB2. This was specifically in response to a radical bill passed in Charlotte. So it's back in 2016. A lot of this unfolded. It's really last year. The year before, there was an attempt to pass this radical bill in Charlotte that would have basically rendered all public bathrooms and locker rooms gender neutral. And private businesses, of course, could do whatever they wanted to do. That private entity didn't make it, pushed through in 2016. In response to North Carolina, legislators said, not in our state, and we're not going to have that happen. And then there was threats from the Obama administration that we would lose billions of dollars in federal funding if, say, a high school did not allow a boy who identified as a girl to play on the girls' soccer team and share their locker room, shower stalls, etc. So just outrageous stuff. The state stood up to it. Governor McCrory lost his reelection bid, I believe the first incumbent governor to lose in North Carolina in a long time. But from what I understand, there were other issues as well. There were a couple of other controversies in terms of stands that he took. And without those, I don't think HB2 alone would have stopped him. And his opponent, Roy Cooper, outspent about 2-1. And some of the major gay activist groups and others with deep pockets got behind him. So even with all the controversy, if they had spent equally, Governor McCrory would have made it in. And apparently, if not for some of the other controversies, one of which had to do with the toll road and things like that, another with relationship to Duke Power, the energy company in North Carolina, I think without those, that he still would have been reelected. But either way, we have been told that this has cost us, HB2, hundreds of millions of dollars. The NCAA has pulled their tournament games from here. The PayPal was going to come into the city and open up, come into Charlotte, open up new jobs. That didn't happen. But others have said, and it's been verified even by liberal websites, you know, it's true. It's basically 0.1% of the economy. And the economy in North Carolina continues to thrive. And all the other big companies based here, Bank America and Google, that have offices here, they haven't moved out. Well, NCAA has now given North Carolina 24 hours to repeal HB2. Of course, Governor Roy Cooper wants to do that. But thus far, the legislators have not been willing to. Republican-led houses. And this is, more bullying, more telling people you cannot hold to sanity, you cannot hold to morality, you cannot hold to your moral convictions, your religious convictions. You must comply with our political correctness or be punished. But right now, the state of Texas is facing the identical thing because Texas is moving to have a bathroom safety bill to say that if you're a biological man, that you can't use the locker room of a woman in a public building and private businesses do whatever they want. This is not an attack on transgender people. This is a way to keep heterosexual predators out and a way to say the biggest concern is not less than 1% of the population that struggles with gender identity and for whom we have compassion. The bigger concern is the 99% who don't, and especially the feeling of safety of women and children. If you live in North Carolina, if you live in Texas, how do you want your legislators to act? Do you want them to stand for principle and what's right and perhaps receive financial penalty because of it? You say, hey, God will make up for that. God will bless us. And if enough states just stood up, then the NCAA and the NFL and NBA and these others, they can't boycott everywhere. The NBA pulled their All-Star game from Charlotte this year. Yet penalized North Carolina. You say if enough states just stood up to these bullies, it would stop. That's what I say. We'll be right back.
Cleansing flame, send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The NCAA has given North Carolina 48 hours to repeal or change HB2, or the state will lose NCAA events through the year 2022, potentially costing hundreds of millions of dollars. The clock is officially ticking.
What kind of bullying is this? You have 24 hours to make your decision. I understand the NCAA is planning things out some time out, but when they decided to pull the games, they pulled them on pretty short notice, did they not? Let us listen to this a little bit more, and we go to clip number 4. Again, the NCAA giving North Carolina 24 hours to make up its mind on this. And I believe this is Bill Malugan on Fox reporting. Go ahead.
PayPal decided to cancel plans for a new facility in Charlotte that would have added an estimated $2.6 billion to the state's economy and 400 new jobs. Deutsche Bank scuttled their plans to add 250 jobs in the Raleigh area, which would have brought in an estimated $547 million by the end of 2027. CoStar Group backed out of negotiations to bring more than 700 jobs to the Charlotte area. Adidas decided to build its first U.S. sports shoe factory near Atlanta instead of High Point. That cost North Carolina about 160 jobs. And VoxPro decided to hire hundreds of customer support workers in Athens, Georgia, instead of the Raleigh area.
Yeah, that's rough. That's ugly. Again, it's bigotry. It's bullying. It needs to be stood up to. And if enough states stood up, if Atlanta stood up, if Texas stood up, if other states stood up, they wouldn't be able to bully like this. Plain and simple. And again, from what I understand, this amounts to 0.1% of the overall budget. Others have not left the state. And let's remember the hypocrisy here. Bank of America was here for years. The NBA was bringing their All-Star game here. PayPal was bringing new business here. I say here, living in North Carolina. All that was going to happen when things were the way they used to be. Okay? And that was the reality. Then Charlotte, North Carolina, radically changed things. HB2 said no, they're going back to the way they were before. And now suddenly everybody's outraged and pulling out. And what's more important, money or morality? People of North Carolina, people of Texas, what's more important, morality or money? And over the process of years, do you think that God cannot more than make up 0.1% if you do what's right and honorable? Even if we lost money, fine. But I believe if we honor God, where money does matter in terms of meeting needs on a practical level and having a strong financial base so that people are helped and healthy in their financial status, great, fine, amen. But I'm quite sure God can more than make up that 0.1%. And I wonder how many have moved here or feel good about being here because of North Carolina taking the stand they have taken. Let's play one more clip. Clip number 5. Again, NCAA giving North Carolina 24 hours to repeal HB2.
According to an in-depth analysis by the Associated Press, HB2 is estimated to cost North Carolina almost $3.8 billion over a span of 12 years. Within the past year, the Tar Heel State has gone through major financial hits because of HB2. All in all, the AP estimates North Carolina has missed out on more than 2,900 jobs because of House Bill 2. On top of that, canceled conventions, concerts, and major sporting events, including the NBA All-Star Game, have deprived North Carolina of more than $196 million. By the end of this year alone, the AP estimates North Carolina will have missed out on more than $525 million, specifically due to HB2.
Isn't it fascinating that reports indicate that the economy in North Carolina is one of the best in America? And that it's one of the friendliest places for businesses in America. And that business and housing and other things seem to be booming. Booming in North Carolina, from what I've read and from what I understand. And again, what's most important in God's sight? This is not a war on transgenders. This is a war on cultural insanity. This is a war on radical political activism. And if you want to push things back, if you want to push things back and recognize where the real problems arose, they arose when Charlotte passed the radical bill because nothing was going wrong before then, meaning that all these businesses were coming here and opening up offices. This is an example of cultural bullying that must be resisted. I'm just looking at here. Chloe Jefferson, student at Greenville Christian Academy, expressed concerns during the special session state lawmakers held last year to pass HB 2. She spoke out against a Charlotte ordinance that would have allowed transgender people to use restrooms corresponding with their gender identity. Quote, changing in front of my girl peers is already intimidating enough. Now we add the possibility of males changing and showering alongside of me. This is something that makes me, and I'm sure other girls, even more self-conscious. Girls like me should never be forced to undress or shower in the presence of boys. Of course! An editorial in the Charlotte Observer said, well, you're just going to have to get used to it. Girls going to have to get used to the presence of male body parts in bathrooms and locker rooms. You're just going to have to get used to it. What kind of nonsense is this? So we need to just wake up, friends. We need to wake up again and say, this is what we're dealing with. Let the NCAA go ahead and bully. Let's be people of principle. And people of Texas, encourage your legislators to, is it SB 6? To vote for that and to have Bathroom Privacy Act. Again, private businesses can do whatever they want to do. They can have a shower stall in the middle of a workroom if they want. They do whatever in the world they want to do. That's their business. It's their business. They can call it as they want. They can say men work on one side of the building and women work on the other side of the building. They can do whatever they want to do. That's their business. They could say our dress code is that everyone has to wear slacks, men and women. Or our dress code is everyone has to wear gowns. They can do what they want to do. If you'd like to work there or do business there, it's your business. It's their business. It's your business. But we need to just come back to sanity, friends. We need to come back to morality. In fact, there's an article that I wrote, and I'm just going to say a little bit about this, and then we're going to switch subjects, and I'm going to go to the phones. I wrote an article based on two emails that were sent to me by an individual, a man who, in rebellion against God, had sex change surgery, lived as a woman, married another man, and together with this husband now, have come to the Lord and really want to serve the Lord. And I found out subsequently they are celibate in their relationship because of the nature of the relationship. This individual that we'll call Irene wrote this to me and said, just read your Transanity article. Thank you for your curt and scripture-based article on this. I am a transgendered person. I struggled all my life. I turned from God and did what I knew was wrong many, many years ago. I was born a male and I live as a female for the last 15 years. God started calling me back a couple of years ago. I rededicated my life to following Jesus and living for him and what he can do for a lost person. I can't change the things I've done to myself and ones that love me. God showed me that I should not promote or be in that community because of the insanity of thinking. God forgiving me for taking my life in my hands was easy. It has always been forgiving myself that has been hard. I'm still a work in progress. I spend time with my Lord and Savior every day. My past is not mine anymore. My future is in God's hand. Again, thank you for your article. I get tired of articles and news promoting the lifestyle. So I asked, again, we'll call this individual Irene, do you feel like God ultimately wants you to identify as female? Response, how God ultimately wants me to identify is confusing. I am married to a loving husband who shares my faith and have been for the last 13 years. It was his mother who got me going back to church and ultimately rededicating my life to Christ. So again, you ultimately have two men who are quote, married, one who had sex change surgery, but they're celibate now because of that. And they're sorting these things out. So how do you view this choice now that you made it? Was my choice to transition what God wanted for my life? No, I don't believe it was. I believe I'd let so much sin into my life that I made selfish, sinful choices in my life. At this point, I don't see God wanting me to destroy a second marriage and destroy a person, my husband. I don't live a life of promoting my choice. In fact, I cringe each time I see on television, online, or read about how great it is for transitioning. I know the pain, the sin, the hurt, and how confused the people are before they make a choice that changes their life forever. They need to have a God conversation instead of a selfish conversation with themselves or some group promoting and encouraging them. Poignant, clear. You can read the article by going to thelineoffire.org and just clicking on the digital library. And notice that Chloe, talking about being a girl and potentially having a boy in her locker room, she didn't care at all. She didn't give a flip about the financial impact and what company's going to come to the North Carolina or not. Nor should she be thinking about that. We'll be right back. If you listened to yesterday's interview with Michael Heiser, Book of Enoch, Background to the New Testament, give me a call. We'll take some calls on that in the last few minutes of today's broadcast. 866-34-TRUTH.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire, 866-348-7884. Hey, glad to see that AFA has sent out an action alert, American Family Association, based largely on the article that I wrote about this. Vimeo removes Christian ministry videos, closes account. Let's respond to this, friends. Let's act on this. Let's get word out to Vimeo. You say, how do I do it? Go to thelineoffire.org. Go there. And when you go there, just look for my article on Vimeo declares war on gospel transformation. And at the end, we give you some practical things that you can do. It won't cost you a dime. Practical things you can do. We do encourage you to buy the DVD, Such Were Some of You. I'm on there as an expert about biblical and cultural issues, but the most powerful part of that video are the testimonies of people who've been transformed, the testimony of those who have encountered Jesus and have found grace to bring deep and wonderful and glorious transformation in their lives. By the way, I'm just going to stay here for a moment on cultural issues. So Bill O'Reilly, one of the best-known folks on secular TV today, the O'Reilly Factor, Fox News, Bill O'Reilly made a silly, disparaging remark about Maxine Waters, Congresswoman Waters, and there was a discussion going on, and she was involved with it, and he said that he couldn't pay attention to it because of the James Brown wig she was wearing. He's apologized for the comments publicly. And as clearly as he made his initial flippant, silly comment, he's apologized, and rightly so. There are calls for his resignation, and others have had to resign for lesser comments and things like that, and being called racist. And I didn't see it as racist. I saw it as stupid. And perhaps I haven't followed him enough. I'm, of course, know his work well, but I haven't watched the show every day or read his columns all the time. So I didn't know if he engaged in that kind of silly stuff on a regular basis. I mean, Rush Limbaugh obviously would on a regular basis, and others might on a regular basis. Did O'Reilly? Apparently not. But just a little lesson for all of us, a little lesson whether you love Bill O'Reilly or don't like Bill O'Reilly at all, just a little practical lesson. May I offer that? Okay. Ecclesiastes 10:1 is an interesting verse. In the King James, it starts with the words dead flies. I've sometimes given that as a little quiz to people. Which verse in the King James begins with the word dead flies? And it actually occurs like that in some other translations at all. But if I can remember the King James from memorizing it probably 44 years ago, dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that has a reputation or that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. So, yeah, let's just see. So doth a little folly him that as in, yeah, okay, I corrected it, is in reputation for wisdom and honor. Let's read it from a couple other translations. HCSB, dead flies make a perfumer's oil ferment and stink. So a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. ESV, dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a stench. So a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. NET, one dead fly makes the perfumer's ointment give off a rancid stench, so a little folly can outweigh much wisdom. New Jewish Publication Society version, dead flies turn the perfumer's ointment fetid and putrid, so a little folly outweighs massive wisdom. Now, why do I bring that up? To the extent you have a voice, to the extent you have respect, to the extent you are trusted, to the extent people listen to you, to the extent people respect your point of view, you might be a pastor, you might be an educator, you might be an internet voice, you might have a voice in many other ways these days. People may look to you, your example. Just be careful not to compromise it by something stupid. I'll be preaching sometimes and something will come to mind. Should I use this illustration? And I think, yeah, I'm going to use it. And then I hear a voice in my mind. It's the voice of my wife, voice of Nancy. I'm not talking about I could be on the other side of the planet. And she's saying, yeah, you don't want to say that. In other words, I'm not actually hearing her voice, but knowing her that well, she's weighing in. It's like, no, it's going to detract from the message, or it's going to seem silly, or you don't want to be doing this in certain company because it won't be understood. You're among family and friends, you know, you act a certain way, and you could, you know, do silly stuff with the little kids, but then when you're, say, in front of national leaders, you don't do the same thing. So here you have Bill O'Reilly, and yeah, of course, people love him, people hate him. He's strong, outspoken, and clear, and largely conservative, etc. And yeah, I understand. He's got people who love him and hate him. And this is not going to make him bigger or better or worse. Or, in other words, overall, he's going to continue as he is, and the people that love him are going to keep loving him, and the people that hate him are going to keep hating him. But it's an unnecessary distraction. It's an unnecessary thing to have used against you. Think of our president. If he tweeted less and said certain things that were less incendiary during the campaign, take all the radical stands, strong stands, clear stands, be a man, be an alpha male, be all that, fine, great. No problem there. That's not my issue. But the unnecessary things, the unnecessary insults, the things that by belittling others belittled him, there would be less to throw against him. Yes, you'd still have people that love him and hate him. I understand that. But now we're coming over to those of us who are seeking to follow the Lord. I'm not looking to Bill O'Reilly as a Christian witness or Donald Trump as a Christian witness. But we who are believers, we are expected to live a certain way. We who are believers, we're expected to conduct ourselves a certain way. And I just was struck by this. For me, the big issue was not Bill O'Reilly. Again, his books are going to sell the way they've sold. His TV show will be as popular as it's been. That's my opinion. And those that hate him are going to hate him all the more. And those that love him are going to say, come on, man, what's the big deal? And they'll laugh at the joke. My point is, let's use this as a teachable moment for ourselves and to say, okay, what would it take for me to disqualify myself in the eyes of others? What would it take for me to compromise myself in the eyes of others or to make people less inclined to take me seriously, less inclined to respect my opinion? I believe it's really important that we ask ourselves, what can we do to enhance respect that people have for us, to enhance any authority that's been given to us, to enhance the reputation that we have that is a good reputation? Because you can build up your reputation for years and years, and it only takes a few seconds to destroy it. So let's live and learn. Got it? All right. Yesterday, fascinating interview with Dr. Michael Heiser, opening up things that for many were completely foreign, new territory. You can get this CD of that interview, plus the book, Reversing Hermon, Book of Enoch, Forgotten Mission of Jesus. It's eye-opening book. Get those together exclusively at thelineoffire.org. Order as many copies as you like. My bottom line today, let's walk in the love of God, but in the fear of God too, being careful with how we live.